This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 257, we're recording on Thursday, April 19th. I'm Jeff O'Neill. I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com.
Hello, hello.
We're back. It's Pulitzer Week, which weirdly doesn't feel like the lead story. We'll get to that in a minute, but we're back. I wanted to say, I was listening to last week's show for a reason that's boring to make sure I got someone's name right, but I realized that we talked about Annotated's new episode, but didn't really say it because I was worried I didn't want to spoil it, blah, blah, blah. But if you haven't listened to it by now, I just want to mention that Annotated Episode 9, the most recent one, is all about the Handbook for Mortals New York Times bestseller list hacking situation that went on.
And it's so bananas.
And we use that kind of as a, you know, there's a lot about Lanny Sarum and Handbook for Mortals and all that stuff. But then we kind of use that as the thin end of the wedge to talk about the art, you know, the structural idiosyncrasies of the New York Times bestsellers, why they could do it, why we care about bestsellers, things like that. I think it's an interesting show. Talked to a lot of people related to it, someone who went to one of her events, Phil Stamper, who was kind of the patient zero of the Twitter investigation of like what this book is. Talked to someone at Vox that went to the bestseller list. Talked to Lila Shapiro, who interviewed and did a profile of Lanny Sarum for Vulture. The most interviews I've ever done for an Annotated episode. And frankly, I had one I didn't even use because there was too much stuff. So jam-packed. Go check it out. I think you like this show. You'll get a deep dive on those shenanigans. And like we had people say on Slack channel, I could listen to the stories about that story for a million years.
It feels like, just given how crazy that story is, there's probably going to be some kind of follow-up. But just it feels a little bit inevitable.
Yeah. And I'll give you, here's a special nugget for those of you guys listening to this show that, you know, I wanted to do something with this. I didn't know what to do with it. But two nuggets about there have been historical bookseller list shenanigans. And the one that really jumped out to me is that Jacqueline Suzanne, who wrote Valley of the Dolls, was the first author to take heat for, we wouldn't even call it gaming the New York Times bestseller list now, but like trying to influence her place on the list by just telling her friends and family to pre-order and buy the book the first week.
And that is so benign.
Like that's all that she did, but it became like a scandal about Valley of the Dolls that she was actively saying, in order to get on the list, if you go buy the book this week, pre-order it, buy it from, I think she even went to say, go buy it from this store or that store. Like, authentically buy it. Like, not do any of these other shenanigans, but, like, pay the money for the real book that you will keep and own, which now is kind of standard practice for authors on social media especially, right? Like, my book's coming out. It'd be great if you pre-ordered and buy it and then rated and reviewed it because it's good for all the algorithms. But there was a point in time which that was controversial, which I found fascinating. So that's special for you guys listening to this show. So that's Valley of the Dolls. There's another one. I'll save another one for nuggets. It's a longer story.
But, there's a lot of good nuggets.
Basically, a lot of good nuggets. Anyway, so go listen to that. All right, let's do a sponsor. The good news. We only got one sponsor this week. Let's take care of it. Give it its day in the sun. And then we'll talk about Pulitzer and stuff.
All right, here we go. Our first and only sponsor this week is The Girl Who Smiled Beads by Clementine Wamaria and Elizabeth Weil. Clementine Wamaria was just 6 years old when her mother and father began to speak in whispers and their neighbors were beginning to disappear. In 1994, she and her 15-year-old sister Claire fled the Rwandan massacre and spent the next 6 years migrating through 7 African countries searching for safety. They were perpetually hungry. They were imprisoned and abused, and they endured and escaped refugee camps. When Clementine was 12, she and her sister were granted refugee status in the United States, and Clementine was taken in by a family who raised her as their own. On the surface, she seemed to live the American dream. She attended private school, she took up cheerleading, and ultimately she graduated from Yale. Yet the years of being treated as less than human and of going hungry and seeing death could not be erased. In The Girl Who Smiled Beads, Clementine Wamaria and Elizabeth Weil provoke us to look beyond the label of victim and recognize the power of imagination to transcend even the most profound injuries and aftershocks. This is devastating, yet beautiful. The Girl Who Smiled Beads is a powerful testament to Clementine's commitment to constructing a life on her own terms. So again, that is The Girl Who Smiled Beads by Clementine Wamaria and Elizabeth Weil.
Follow up. I want to now see a play about this. now I'm getting super meta. Like, so we talked about the lawsuit that the Harper Lee Estate is bringing against the Aaron Sorkin Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird that's being produced by Scott Rudin. Basically, for those of you who don't remember or didn't hear the first time, they are saying that his adaptation is not, quote-unquote, faithful to the spirit of To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know, I don't know if it says what they want. Do they want damages? Do they want it taken off the board? Do they want to call it to mock a killing bird? Like, yeah, I mean, I don't, do they want
to call mock a
I don't know what they want exactly, but a prominent Broadway producer, probably the only twist besides the resolution that we talk about on the show because it's so interesting, is that a producer has offered to stage a single performance of the Sorkin adaptation inside a federal courthouse to prove that the play is faithful to the novel, which really is awesome for like 9,000 ways, but not the least of which is I love plays within a play.
Mm-hmm.
But also, since so much of the play takes place in a courthouse... You're in a courthouse.
Watching a play about a courthouse.
Like there's not even a fourth wall to break because you are the fourth wall if you're in this. And there's a jury. I guess there would be a judge. That would the judge play the judge? Could you get that? Probably wouldn't work.
That's a little on the nose.
Some sort of
ethics. A
little on the nose. But I think it's incredible, and I hope this happens.
I hope it happens.
Whatever else
too.
Happens with this story, I hope this happens.
Like I need this to happen, just to know that it's happening in the world. That there is a Broadway production being mounted inside a Manhattan courtroom. Over Harper Lee shenanigans of all things, but then I really need the video to exist. Like, see, like, and would it have to be the real actors that are cast in it, or would they use other people? Like, I'm not super shipping the notion of Jeff Daniels playing Atticus Finch, but I like the idea of Jeff Daniels as Atticus Finch in the play, inside the play, in the courtroom, inside the courtroom.
Yes. It's incredible. Well, the way these things normally go is, I guess he's already signed on to play the part, so it's in production, so he's probably got the lines all ready to go. But as you're getting a show ready for Broadway, as I know, because a friend of the show, Jeremy, helps us with Annotated, he writes musicals and does this all the time, is usually there's a reading, which you get some actors to read the parts, but they may not be cast for the actual production. So they I don't know if they have stand-ins or the people that could do it right away. The other thing that's going on here, too, is that Rudin has countersued the Lee estate for challenging the adaptation because...
Hard to get investors.
Hard to get investors, as you know, when you don't know if the thing is going to exist. So it's really put them in a bind. They've already, I'm sure, shelled out a lot of money to make the thing happen. It's a huge mess, and the only whipped cream on this pile of mud is that we might get an adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird as evidence for determining whether or not... Which... I mean, it's absurd, but it kind of makes sense in the same way, too, because like if a judge has to rule whether or not the play is violating the spirit, you kind of have to see how it's performed, not just the
right.
words on the page, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the embodiment of that character makes a big difference. And
yeah,
the core of it was around how I remember from the first piece about this, mm-hmm. that the central objection that the Harper Lee estate is making is about the depiction of Atticus Finch and his character. And it sounds like maybe Sorkin has worked in some of the Atticus Finch of Ghost at a Watchman before he evolved into the Atticus Finch of To Kill a Mockingbird, and that the Lee estate is not pleased with that. Tanya Carter is not pleased. I actually, this is the thing that I want. You know how when you're watching a courtroom thing on TV, the camera pans to like the people sitting in the peanut gallery. I want to watch Tanya Carter's face while this gets performed in the courtroom. Like just bouncing back and forth between like her face and the judge and like Aaron Sorkin sitting in the corner looking smug.
Yes, I like it. What I want is the same pan, but going from the person playing the judge up to sitting above him, the actual judge watching the fake judge. That's the pan. And then the real jury being panned to the people playing the jury. And then the real prosecuting attorneys being like... It's a fact. I want all of it.
It's bonkers. I need this to happen.
If you do
I
it
hope
just right,
the judge
you
says
might,
yes.
If you do it right, you might create a rip in the space-time continuum. Like right at the center of the whole thing, there might be like a little pinprick in the fabric of space-time that I, you know, which itself would be very interesting, I would say. Let's see.
I would never have guessed that this would be how this story would progress.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Basically, the nut quote from Rudin, I think, has rendered it impossible for the play to premiere as scheduled in December 2018. Unless the dispute is resolved in the immediate future, the play will be canceled. fascinating stuff. If you know, and also if you live in, this is in a New York, he's suing in New York. So this is not the Alabama suit, which they're trying to have dismissed. The countersuit is in New York, and it's easier to get Broadway talent in New York. But it could be that you could go attend this if it's open to the public.
What if it's just performed by, like, community theater?
That would be so great. There's, like, there's like Mr. Dale, that's, like, the orthodontist for the town.
Yes.
Playing Atticus Finch.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He was... yeah, he was in our town, and you know,
he looks
to wild acclaim in the Catskill Community Theater's production of Bridge on the River Kwai.
He looks like Taylor from the Gilmore Girls.
Oh yes, I want that too. And now I want the Stars Hollow Community Theater production.
Yes, yeah, that's it. That's just all I need
of Sorkin's. But for the record, for the law. Anyway, so there's enough silliness about that. But in all fairness, we didn't come up with this. I wish we would have thought of this
idea. I
do, too.
I wish that we had been like, what if they performed the play?
What if they did it?
Now we know. This was just outside my imagination.
That's the main story. Yep, that's for us, that was the thing we wanted to talk about. Now it's on to the Pulitzer Prizes.
Which were surprising.
They were. Yes, they were surprising. Well, the ones a week.
Yes.
Well, okay. Honestly, we follow the fiction prize.
Correct.
I'm not speaking out of turn, right?
No.
Like, we're interested in the nonfiction prize, but we were saying in their back channels that, like, there's so many nonfiction books, that one's impossible to predict. Usually, the Pulitzer for fiction comes from a relatively small pool of, you know, there's a couple of favorites, and oftentimes you can guess.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like about half the time we get this right, or we're you know, the finalists, two out of three finalists we had on our radar. This was not one of those years.
It was not.
What won? What won, Rebecca? Tell
Less
the people what
by Andrew Sean Greer, which I remember when it came out. I think it sponsored all the books one week. It was kind of like half on
it
my radar.
It sponsored Annotated.
Yeah.
Season one of Annotated had a spot on Annotated.
I've heard people say
like
nice
Andrew
things
Sean
about
Greer.
It.
I've read I recommended when it came out The Confessions of Max Tivoli Up and Down the Waterfront a whole bunch of times.
Mm.
I read and liked but didn't love The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells. But this book I hadn't read because I don't read a lot of front list fiction these days. And it won, which shocked everyone. There's a very charming, I'll see if I can find it put in the show notes, Twitter thread yeah. from Greer, who was teaching in Italy, who didn't believe it. And so called up Michael Chabon. And Michael Chabon was like screaming to him on the phone.
It's real.
That it's happening.
Yeah. So
so that's delightful.
I had to, and I Googled like what the book is about because I was not sure. So it's, this is the synopsis straight from Amazon. If you are also wondering what the book is about, who says you can't run away from your problems? You are a failed novelist about to turn 50. A wedding invitation arrives in the mail. Your boyfriend of the past 9 years is engaged to someone else. You can't say yes. It would be too awkward. And you can't say no because it would look like defeat. On your desk are a series of invitations to half-baked literary events around the world. How do you arrange to skip town? You accept them all. What could possibly go wrong? Starts off there. The character Arthur Less will almost fall in love in Paris, almost fall to his death in Berlin, barely escape to a Moroccan ski chalet from a Saharan sandstorm, accidentally book himself as the only writer in residence at a Christian retreat center in southern India, and encounter on a desert island in the Arabian Sea the last person on earth he wants to face. But he will also find his first love, who will be his last. Actually, I'm into this. It sounds like fun.
It sounds fun. I guess that...
You don't usually get fun.
I guess
fun.
The funness of it is not what... Yes, exactly right.
Yeah, this sounds, and not this is not a diminutive term at all. I love books that do this, but this sounds like something that I would want to read, like on vacation. You know, this sounds like a novel that I could sink into on a flight and just enjoy the story and be like compelled along by the characters. And that's like that's a great thing for fiction to do. Typically, though, the Pulitzer, like these book awards, tend to go to like capital S and capital F serious fiction, I think that's a nice shift to see this go to a book that seems to be light and to have a sense of humor about itself, but very surprising. And as you were saying, no one was more surprised by this than the author himself.
It sounds on its surface, and again, we're trying to relate our reaction without trying to crap on the book, because we're not interested in that at all. But it sounds like a fairly decent read-alike to, like, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which is a book both of you and I really like. You know, like, it's a midlife crisis kind of situation, mm-hmm. comedic romp.
Some capers,
you know,
a
little outsized things going on, which I'm here for kinds of books. Like, that's the kind of book I'd like to read. But as a Pulitzer winner, if Where You Go, Bernadette would have won, we'd be equally shocked, I guess.
I think that's a great comparison.
Books
that have, like, zany fun just don't often end up winning these kinds of awards. And I would like to see more of that. I think that there's great and interesting stuff going on in fiction that's not super serious and everyone's dying all the time. And I'm looking forward to reading this and sort of finding out for myself what's going on there, but just really interesting. I always am also fascinated by the way that the Pulitzer works, where you don't know what any of the finalists are until the winners are announced. And then you also find out what the other finalists were at the same time. So the other two finalists for the fiction prize were In the Distance by Hernan Diaz, which I'm not familiar with at all, and The Idiot by Elif Batuman, which I know Liberty loved. I've heard great things about, but I haven't picked up on my own. And those, I think, are also both surprising choices, or at least they weren't obvious choices for folks kicking around who they thought it was going to be. I know on the Insiders Slack, there was a lot of sort of pulling for and guessing that Pachinko by Min Jin Lee would be either the winner or at least on the list of finalists. That was a big one last year. I didn't have any super great guesses other than Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmyn Ward, but I felt pretty confident about that one.
That was what we were guessing, and that would have been the predictable winner. And again, it sounds like we're crapping on all these. We don't mean to do any. We're not trying to crap on any of these. But that would have been one where, like, yes, that got a claim. It's in the right mode. It feels of the moment. It has kind of the right register that you'd expect of a Pulitzer winner. The Idiot, also, I should mention, is a comic novel. For some reason, that got a little bit more buzz. I felt like if The Idiot would have won, I would have been less surprised than less by Andrew Sean Greer. And then the other one by Hernan Diaz is not a book I'd heard of, a Coffeehouse Press book. It actually also sounds interesting. Also a travel, kind of a Roman Aclef, it sounds like, a little bit.
Oh, interesting.
An interesting group together there. Any of the other winners jump out to you? I mean, it's kind of the de rigueur, general nonfiction poetry and biography ones. Like, a couple of them I've heard of. I haven't read any of them, but they all feel like the kinds of things you would expect to win. Frank Bidart, one for poetry, the collected poems, Prairie Fires, the Caroline Fraser's biography, Laura Ingalls Wilder, general nonfiction of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, feels of the moment about mass incarceration and race, feels like something people are actively thinking about and interested in right there. I've heard of that book and nothing but raves from it before. But that's the Pulitzer winners.
Yeah, you know, I think notably the big notable one in the literature, you know, section here is the music winner, really, this year.
Kendrick Lamar's
album Damn won. And I love reading this prize committee's description of Kendrick Lamar, but a virtuosic song collection unified by its vernacular authenticity and rhythmic dynamism that offers affecting vignettes capturing the complexity of modern African-American life. But the first time that a hip-hop artist has won a Pulitzer, certainly. I saw Roxane Gay say on Twitter that, like, this is deserving, and also Beyoncé's Lemonade album should have won a Pulitzer, and I would like to co-sign that. But I think that is... Kendrick Lamar's work is really important. Talk about being of the moment, and like finger on the pulse and all of those other phrases that we use to mean, like, this piece of art is really about what is happening right now. Hard to beat that album, and it's really cool to see a Pulitzer committee acknowledge that. Like, it's usually also, you know, serious music that takes itself seriously that wins these kinds of things, and
neoclassical
his work seriously,
right? I don't know enough about the current music scene, but I was scrolling through, because, like, I was like, has a popular artist ever won before? And really the closest, like, Wynton Marsalis, which is jazz, and then Ornette Coleman. I wouldn't really call that. It's not pop music, frankly.
Right.
It just isn't. I wonder how influenced, or was there any loosening of the pickle jar for this from Dylan's Nobel win?
Oh, interesting.
Because I saw some people say this is the first major literary prize that a popular musician ever won. I was like, I don't want to get crazy, but.
Well, I think though popular in their own time, you know, like Bob Dylan didn't win the Pulitzer in the 70s.
Yeah, right. He didn't win it in 1968. Yeah. That's for sure.
Maybe so.
But in terms of pop music writ large, a welcome change from my point of view.
I think it's very
probably
cool.
I would guess there's a certain, I would imagine, and I could understand it, like much like the blowback that the man Booker is getting for letting Americans in, I would imagine the classical music community is not thrilled, if only because this is their time to shine. Where Kendrick Lamar, popular music, they're popular for a reason. I don't know. I don't really care about that, but I'd imagine that community would not. Are they thrilled by this? Because like there are not that many places to highlight contemporary classical. I don't know. That just a thought that occurred to me. Yeah, is like,
I haven't read any of these, so I'm just guessing, you know, I think you're right that there probably are some of those objections, but it feels to me like they're probably along the same kind of tension as that tension that exists between like, how come I can't get my work of popular fiction that's sold a million copies to be reviewed by the New York Times? I would like to be, you know, like that you can't get commercial success and the literary accolades at the same time. Like, you know, everybody listening to this show knows who the writers are that talk about these things.
Yes.
And
right.
That Kendrick Lamar certainly has commercial success and has certainly been recognized in venues other than by this Pulitzer committee for the kind of art and the quality of the art that he's making. I am all for the blending of commercially successful and credit for great art where credit is due. So I kind of don't care if the classical art, like if you want your classical stuff to, if you really want to be recognized, make good enough interesting neoclassical stuff that it competes with Kendrick Lamar, frankly, for how.
And I feel the same way about the man Booker. If it is what it is, like if you want to beat the Americans, beat the Americans.
Yeah, be relevant.
That's my particular take on it. But, you know, also, you know, I feel like so many of these categories, like they break up biography and history. Could you have one for pop music and classical? I mean, could you do two Pulitzers? Would that kill you? Would it kill you? It's 15 grand. I'm sure your publicist for this costs 10 times that. Anyway, that's a different rant for a different day. I'm sure Kendrick Lamar will appreciate the 15 large. All right. So the most interesting thing about the literature Pulitzer was the music.
Yep.
Pulitzer, it turns out. I feel like I should be more interested, who cares if I'm interested in the less book itself, which I'm nominally interested. I feel like I should be more interested in it winning, but I don't have anything interesting to say about it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I don't know
I
what else
like
to do with that.
I need to have read it to figure out what's interesting about it being the winner. So maybe ask me in a couple of weeks.
Right, yeah. Do they tell us the judges yet?
Oh, I don't
think so. Do we remember? Don't they usually tell us the judges after the fact?
C-2018 board members. This is just the board that I'm looking at.
This is good podcast. So looking at Google stuff.
Let me tell you about the internet I'm looking at. Yeah, I can't see the
I guess
list of judges.
That thing I've come to find about the Pulitzer that's as interesting, maybe even more interesting than the actual winner, is who are the people that reckon. Mm-hmm. So like how the Pulitzer work is you have a rotating committee of people related to the book world that then recommend books to the larger Pulitzer board. We've talked about this, whatever year that was, when there was no award, which apparently the larger board gave the big stanky boot to all the recommended titles.
I think, that was way back in 2012, I think.
Yeah. So who is recommending what to whom is the Pulitzer. I mean, that for all else that we talk about it, that's the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. It's like this small group of people recommending a selected group of books to a wider group of people that vote. I think that wider board votes on all of these things. Like they're getting finalists from all of these, the criticism, commentary, feature writing prize, so on and so forth. So anyway, there you go. Go check it out. If you've read less, shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Love to hear about it. All right. Tech stuff.
Yay, tech stuff.
Can we do tech stuff?
Been a while since we had one that was actually interesting.
Yeah, before we get to the tech thing, I just a quick note, Meta Book World stat that we had never heard before. Amazon released this week, maybe even yesterday, that it has 100 million Amazon Prime subscribers, which is a number they have never reported before. That's a global number, and they've been up for 13 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have thought this is more or less. I wouldn't have a yardstick. I know that a darn high percentage of the people in my circle of life do mm-hmm. Amazon Prime. I thought was interesting is there was, I don't think it's in this link that I dropped in the show notes, Rebecca, that you can see, but it lined up how that compares to other subscription services, which I thought was fascinating. Like Netflix has 125 million paid subscribers worldwide. If you would ask me if there's more Prime or Netflix, I would have had a hard time guessing. So that felt, I don't know, salient to me. What I would have guessed about Netflix Prime or Netflix versus mm-hmm. Prime, I guess, is something I thought you should care about. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I was like, that's boring. No one cares. But Spotify, 87 million subscribers, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
And then Apple Music, 40 million subscribers.
Oh, that's surprising.
If you
would have
told me that Apple Music is almost half Amazon Prime, I think I would have been
shocked
by that.
That is the most interesting number that you've said so far. That.
Oh, really? Tell me more about that.
I'm surprised that the Apple Music thing is that high. Like, and maybe that's just that the circle, my internet circle at least, is people who enjoy being, you know, like iTunes just keeps getting worse and worse, and why would I subscribe to an Apple Music thing when I already have Spotify or Prime Music or Pandora? Like, you know, the Apple subscription service came out much later than many of the other music subscription and streaming services. So I'm just surprised by that it's almost half. Yeah. I would have guessed probably closer to a quarter.
Yeah. Yeah, about 100 million. I don't know. They don't break it down by country or anything like that. It's a big number, though. That is a big number. And I think somewhat, maybe it's properly rated by people who do such things, but when people talk about Amazon's dominance, I know from my own anecdata, the Prime thing is real. Mm-hmm. In terms of lock-in and using it and knowing you don't have to pay for shipping in 2-3 days and so on and so forth. Like, that is a real incentive that is hard to, it's hard for other people to match. And that they bundle in a bunch of the other, you know, the movie services. Like, when you think about it, it's a super weird product. You get free shipping and you get The Man in the High Castle. Yeah. Like, it's a weird product. like that's a weird combo.
Right.
So I don't know. Is it because it's just a big Easter basket full of value that not all of it relates to each other? But I guess it's working.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to know. Maybe this is something we could do quickly. If for those of you who are on Amazon Prime, like, why do you use it? Is it the shipping, or you get the shipping because you're signing up to watch Mozart in the Jungle or whatever else it might be? Like, what's the thin of the wedge that got your camel under the tent? I'm making my business.
What is happening over there?
Do you know that phrase, the nose and the camel's nose under the tent?
I do, like, but just
the,
it was
to get a camel into a tent, you got to get the nose in first. So the hardest thing is to get the nose.
Yeah, and it was just the mixing of metaphors.
Let me tell you about camels and tents, Rebecca. Can we talk about camels and tents and how difficult they are to get?
And ends of wedges, and yeah,
I don't know.
It was a lot, Jeff. That was a lot of metaphors
in one
place.
It's a metaphorical bundle, much like Amazon Prime. They may not be related, but all of those metaphors have value. Just bundle them together. They're worth more. You decouple the price proposition from the price. That's what bundling does. Okay.
All right, let's move on.
Now that I've returned from my fugue state, why don't you tell me about Google Books and something totally that makes sense?
So Google has launched a new thing called Talk to Books, which is a way to get answers on the internet. It's powered by AI, and the AI tool scans every sentence in 100,000 volumes of Google Books to generate a list of likely responses with the relevant passages in bold. So, I've been meaning to try this out myself before this show, and I didn't quite get to it. But it says in this piece from Quartz that Talk to Books will tackle any query you have, however trivial, esoteric, or abstract. So if you ask it, how can I stop thinking and fall asleep? And I swear, Jeff, this is in the article. It is not a thing that I'm saying to poke at you about falling asleep at night. But let's just say that you were interested in turning off your brain and going to sleep. You could ask Talk to Books, and it would give you passages from things like Self-Hypnosis for Dummies and Thriving at College, Make Great Friends, Keep Your Faith, and Get Ready for Something That Whose Title Gets Cut Off in This Piece. But that you can give yourself reassuring messages that you could gradually fall asleep, or you could send your mind to do something restful. If you ask it, what should I have for dinner? You'll get an answer like, is it late in the afternoon and you still have no idea what to make for dinner? Dinner can be stressful when you don't plan ahead. So like, it sounds to me like Talk to Books will validate your feelings more than it will actually answer your questions.
Super weird, right?
You can ask it, what is love? And it will give you a quote from The Invention of Autonomy, a History of Modern Moral Philosophy by Jerome Schneewind, which sounds like it was made up just for The Good Place. About what genuine love is. I feel like, not going to actually be useful, but might be quite entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of like a real fancy magic eight ball. Yeah. Like, it doesn't actually mean anything, but like your reactions to the non-meaning might be more interesting.
It's like a
The first thing I thought shock. About this is like, wasn't this what basically Bartlett's Familiar Quotations is and was? Like, it'd be a big book of quotations. You'd look up, I don't know, optimism, and he'd give you a bunch of like Henry James quotes or something.
Yeah.
Actually, that you didn't know Henry James quotes about optimism, but you get what I'm saying right there. Is like, so in that way, I guess that's an interesting idea. It's trying in a way to granularize and expand what basically the old subject category in the Library of Congress it would be, like, you know, a way to get at the content of a book. But this is going all the way down the sentence or paragraph level. So I can see how it would be fun. Maybe there's a serendipitous, or I didn't know this thing existed. I feel like you could build a fun party game.
You could.
Based on this.
Yeah.
Like, maybe if you whispered to Talk to Google or Talk to Books, like, something, and then the whole group got to hear, and you had to reverse engineer, like, what was the query that resulted in this particular result? But you know what? I like bonker stuff like this. I don't know if this is good, but I like people trying stuff like this.
That's like the nerdiest dinner party game ever, but it sounds great. They distinguish in this the piece here in course that this is about semantic search, which searches based on meaning rather than on keywords or phrases. So it's looking for like what's going on in sort of your natural language use. And they even do note here that this is best used as a book discovery or an inspiration gathering tool that could be used like for brainstorming new angles on a topic, but you're probably actually not going to walk away with a lot of tips about how to fall asleep at night or real answers to what love is, but it'll give you something to noodle on in the meantime. I do think it's cool and interesting. And you could maybe, if you asked, you know, what is love, and you got enough quotes from enough books, you might come up with some good ones.
It does make me think, too. I mean, again, I think this is before the book riot was up and going in earnest, about the controversy about Google scanning all the books and making the search results available. And maybe people who do hardcore research than I do use this thing. But it's weird how that, like, this is the thing it's turned into. Like, all that effort and, like, kind of a random effect generator that's like, okay, semantic natural language, like, hit all the AI buzzwords, like, congratulations. But, like, this is the best thing we could come up with, is sort of like a random quote generator based on topics. Like, you can do that in Goodreads. It feels like we should have been more. And also, they got Ray Kurzweil to unveil it, who's like a futurist weirdo who like eats 500 pills a day because he's going to live forever.
Oh,
like,
that's him?
That's him. So it just feels a little bit like sound and fury signifying nothing. And it's really like, keyword search. Congratulations. I don't know. It's too bad, I guess. There we go. All right.
I'm here for it if anybody wants to submit their own queries to Talk to Books and tell us what answers you get.
Let's end on the scheme.
The scheme.
The scheme, which we were joking
which
about.
Which is actually called the scheme.
The scheme. Well, this is an awesome program. Super good idea that Penguin Random House UK is putting on. Oh, there's a link to the show notes. It's called The Scheme. And basically what they're trying to do is get more diverse, representative people into the publishing industry. And it is a an early career program which values ideas and potential over experience and qualifications. They have 10 paid editorial traineeships on offer. I'm assuming that's like an internship. I don't know. I don't have my Babelfish English to English translator fish in my ear. Starting in September 2018 for 6 months, it's a chance to experience life in a publishing house, to find out what editorial work is like, and to build the basics you'll need to start a career in publishing. So if you're in the UK, and if you are from a BAME, which is Black, Asian, or Minority Ethnic Community, and or from a socially economic disadvantaged background, you can find more details and you will be eligible. Do not worry if you don't know the first thing about publishing. You just need an interest in storytelling, an enthusiasm for new ideas, and a desire to communicate those ideas. I think this is exactly the kind of thing they should be doing. I don't know if they should call it the scheme, because in American English, the scheme is kind of like, you know, Mr. Burns' hands.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
We've been told, I guess we talked about a version of this last year that was called A Scheme or something, and we had one of our wonderful UK listeners tell us, you guys, it doesn't sound as nefarious in the US. We got explained that it actually just means more like a plan. But as I said before, well, you know what? In the US, pants are pants. They aren't whatever like naughty bits they are over in the UK. I've never quite understood it. But you know what? The scheme in here means it's like a heist. It's like you're trying to get away with something a little bit. But this is a great program. I would love someone out there that listens to this show that's a, you know, kind of a civilian interested in books, maybe looking for a new career path or wants to get in publishing, that you'd be up. Please go enter this.
Yes.
I'd love to hear success stories. If you know someone that did this, I'd love to hear about this. Cause like this is the thin end of the camel, as I so accurately put it earlier in the show, to getting more people into the publishing world.
We can't actually end there. We have two quick things to do. The first is to remind...
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. All right. We can't end with the thin end of the camel. All right,
we can't end with the thin end of the camel, but you can hold on to that. We just need to remind our good friends listening to the show that we're still giving away 15 the best new mysteries of the year so far. All of them are from diverse authors, meaning people of color and LGBTQ authors. The giveaway is open until May 9th. It includes titles like Down the River Unto the Sea by Walter Mosley, Killing in C Sharp by Alexia Gordon, Death at the Durbar by Arjun Raj Gained, and many more. If you would like to enter, you can do that at bookriot.com/mystery giveaway. Again, that is open through May 9th. You'll win 15 of the best new mysteries of the year, all from people of color and LGBTQ authors. bookriot.com/mystery giveaway. And just because it's been a long time since we had a moment of delight on this podcast, because the world is a little light on the delightful moments these days. Our moment of delight is that there is a new thing called Storytime in Space, which is exactly what you think it is. The Global Space Education Foundation is making videos that are available on YouTube of astronauts reading books to kids. And so you can hang out with your kid and watch an astronaut read a children's story. And I watched a couple of these earlier. It's like exactly what my heart needed. Basically, nothing is cooler than your bedtime story is coming from outer space. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well.
What if they beamed us the production of To Kill a Mockingbird from space?
They build a courtroom inside the International Space Station.
It's like one of those old, it's like, I'm sure there's like an old SNL skit or something where I used to like, what about Romeo and Juliet in space?
Yeah.
What about To Kill a Mockingbird, but in space? Like, all of them. Actually, you know what? I'd watch both of those.
I totally would too.
I totally would watch both of those. That's our show. Email us about some of this ridiculousness at podcast@bookriot.com. I guess I'd especially like to know if you have opinions, if you've read especially Less by Andrew Sean Greer, help us out there. If you have any experience with the scheme, any questions about that, or you know some more information we should say about it, I'd like to support that program, get the word out, and find some good folks to try that. That's our show. We will talk to you next week.
Have a good one.